Let's take a look at my NXT rookie. Let's take a look at Husky Harris. Husky, come out here. Show them all. Show them what you're working with here. Take that vest off. Come on. Unfortunately, Husky is... He represents the average male. Average. I mean, with your horrible tattoos.
Well, that's it. Irony is dead.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. Tonight, WWE goes to hell, and I've got predictions for you. CM Punk is the new AEW World Champion, but it's going to be a while before we see him back in the ring. He's going to be going under the knife shortly, which has thrown plans for the Forbidden Door show into chaos. But he is still the AEW World Champion. We'll talk about that and the MJF promo from Wednesday night. What I think they should be doing with MJF in light of this recent news. You know, between the MJF stuff and the CM Punk news, this has been the most newsworthy week in AEW history. Plus, I've got thoughts on last night's NXT In Your House show. And Jeff Jarrett pays Steve Austin a visit on the Broken Skull sessions. Austin finally agreed to work with him. It only took 23 years. This is episode 759 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 5th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. And this is a historic episode because after 13 years on Podbean, this is the first episode to be hosted on Spreaker. I am happy to announce that we are now a Spreaker Prime partner. This has been in the works for a while, but it became official this week. The migration happened this week. The good news is that there's absolutely nothing that you have to do. You don't have to do anything any differently. You can still listen to the Sound Off on all the usual platforms, including the Podbean app. The show should still be updating on there, even though we're no longer hosted there. At least for a little while longer. But you got Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, all these different places. You can also download the free Spreaker app and listen through there. I would encourage you all to do that. You can leave comments under each new episode. And if you download the app, do me a favor. And in the Spreaker app, find the show and hit the star icon to like and follow the show. But again, everything should still work for you as it always does if you are subscribed to the show. And you can drop a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. When you go there now, you're going to see the link tree. You'll see the PayPal button is the first one on top. That is where you can go to support the show. Again, the Podbean page is still up, but it won't be for much longer. So that is the place to go to drop a dono. But again, thank you to everybody who saw the tweet a few days ago that Spreaker posted, which was very nice of them to do. Proud to be part of the Spreaker family, and only bigger and better going forward now. But again, it shouldn't impact any of you in any kind of negative way. If you want to make a donation, again, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. First, though, I want to send a special birthday shout-out to Webmaster Mike from SE Scoops, or shall I call you Cyber Sherbert? He'll get the reference if he hears this. Can you believe it's been 25 years? Holy shit. Happy birthday to Cherubin, who's celebrating a birthday this Tuesday. And a belated birthday shout-out to the one and only Kevin Castle, one of my fellow podcaster brothers in arms. Even though his arms may have more tattoos than mine do, I hope it was a good birthday and you didn't waste too much of it watching SmackDown. Shout out to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Thank you, Paul, for the support. Awesome Anthony Anguiano, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Big B Brian Pissera, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, John Raging Mad Riffle, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Caleb Showtime Lindley, the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Kamelotes, the Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, Iowan Corn Farmer Jesse Lampier, who was at Raw in Des Moines last Monday, Dean the Mighty Mo Mowbray. Got to give a shout out to Dean. He does some great work with his paintings. You can buy prints from his Etsy store called Scenescape Shop. All one word, Scenescape Shop. He's starting up work on a bunch of new wrestling paintings. His latest one that I just saw, he sent it to me the other day, is DDP. Looks really good. That's available right now. And he's going to be painting a new one every month. He is open to suggestions from all of you as to who they should be. And orders of $35 or more get free shipping. And as a special thank you, Solomonster listeners get 20% off all artwork in his Etsy store when you use the code Solomonster at checkout. So look for Scenescape Shop on the Etsy website, and also make sure that you check out his Patreon under the same name. For as little as $5 a month, you get a welcome pack. You get a free print of your choice every month. He's also got a Scenescape Shop YouTube channel where he posts a new time-lapse video every Thursday of him painting, which is very relaxing. So definitely give that a look. He does some great work. And finally here, shout out to Amir. Amir Latran. He is a rapper. He is a producer. And he has been listening to the podcast for the past 10 years. And on Friday, he dropped his new single called John Cena, which you could hear some of playing in the background right now. You can listen to the full track on Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Music. And go ahead and follow him on Instagram, at Amir Latran, AmirLatran, as well as on YouTube by the same name. Again, I already told him privately, but Amir, good shit. And you guys can check it out. I think you'll like it too. This year marks 25 years since the very first Hell in a Cell match at Bad Blood between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, which in my opinion is still to this day the greatest Hell in a Cell match of all time. Undertaker and Mankind may have been more memorable, but as a match, and you throw in the Kane debut, the first one still tops the list. And that Kane debut wins for the greatest debut in WWE history also. Everything about it stands the test of time. Michaels had cost Undertaker the title at SummerSlam. That kicked off their feud. Up to that point, they had never had a singles match on television. They never had a program together. And they had overlapped in that company for a good 7 years, or almost 7 years by that point. So them finally facing off was a big deal at the time. And they had a wild brawl at Ground Zero where Triple H interfered pretty much at will. And so they had to come up with an idea for the rematch to settle things. And the idea was that it would be a cage match to keep anybody from interfering. But it was Jim Cornette, who was on the creative team at that time, who suggested a different kind of cage match. One that had a top on it, like the War Games matches. So that would make it clear that no way in for someone outside trying to come in, and there would be no way out for the people inside. Now, of course, you look back on even the very first Hell in a Cell, and they did end up fighting outside the cage, but that was the idea. It's very different than the escape the cage rules we usually saw in and still see in WWE with the blue bar cage, you know, back in the day. And he suggested that the cage be made wider, like the ones that Jerry Lawler used in Memphis, where they would be able to wrestle outside the ring and still be trapped inside the cage. They also had to come up with a way to debut Kane, and that's when they came up with the idea of having him walk out and rip the cell door off its hinges, which just made for a great visual. After that, they had a brand new gimmick. Brand new gimmick match, well, brand new gimmick in Kane, but they had a brand new gimmick match that they could use to pay off a personal issue between two people. But as with so many other things, they eventually ran it into the ground to where today it's a shell of what it used to be. Right down to the ugly red paint job they gave it, which just makes it harder to see through. There have been a total of 50 Hell in a Cell matches since 1997. 50 of them in the span of 25 years. In a perfect world, there wouldn't have even been 25 of them in 25 years. Less is more. They would have been saved for the rarest of occasions. So when somebody would scream, you know, hell in a cell, people would kind of sit up in their seat and go, holy shit, we're getting another cell match. Shit's about to get real. And nobody does that anymore. Because Hell in a Cell is now, it's an annual tradition. And annual traditions can be fine. Look, War Games was an annual tradition. Right? But even War Games, when it was used in its infancy, it was used to settle a really personal issue between certain people, whether it was Dusty and the Horsemen and the Road Warriors and Sting or whoever was in there, you know, Sting and the Dangerous Alliance. There have been a lot of classic War Games matches. But Hell in a Cell has become an annual tradition. What really killed the concept was giving it its own pay-per-view. So now, instead of dusting off the cell when it's needed, you look at the calendar and go, oh, it's June. It's time for the cell. Or it used to be October. It's October. It's time for Hell in a Cell. But there have been some great cell matches over those 25 years outside of the first two. Triple H and Cactus Jack and No Way Out in 2000. Not as good as their street fight at the Royal Rumble, but still a very good match. Brock Lesnar against The Undertaker at No Mercy in 2002. Even their second cell match in 2015, that was a great blow-off for their feud. Triple H and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 28 with that great false finish with Shawn Michaels. The New Day and the Usos in 2017 had a great tag team, a greatest tag team Hell in a Cell match I've ever seen. Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch in 2019. The only redeeming thing about that pay-per-view from 2019 was the opening match between Becky and Sasha. Sasha Banks and Bayley in 2020. No live fans, it was the whole Thunderdome thing, but they had an excellent Hell in a Cell match. And the most recent one, the 50th one, at Crown Jewel last year between Seth Rollins and Edge. I thought they did the stipulation proud and they had an excellent match. I can only hope that Seth works his magic again with Cody tonight. The last time Cody Rhodes stepped into the cell was in 2009. As part of Legacy, it was a loss to DX. And that was a very different Cody Rhodes than the one we see today in WWE. Tonight is Hell in a Cell from a sold-out Allstate Arena in Chicago, or Rosemont, which is a suburb of Chicago. I don't want to piss off all the Rosemont people. You look at this lineup, and it looks like one of those split-brand pay-per-views. Every match announced up until Friday night was a Monday Night Raw match. There was no SmackDown representation whatsoever. And then finally on Friday, they announced one SmackDown match. It's not for the tag team titles. They already gave us that on Friday. It's not for the SmackDown women's title. Natalya won a six-pack challenge to earn a future shot at Ronda Rousey. That future is not tonight. No, they added a no-holds-barred match between Happy Corbin and Madcap Moss, who is still going by the Madcap name, but he has ditched the suspenders and the bad jokes. He's more serious now. And the only possible outcome to this match is a Madcap win. Because if he doesn't win this match, coming off the angle with Corbin trying to cripple him and put him out of the business, then this is all just a giant waste of time. So Madcap Moss is going to win this match. We have Kevin Owens one-on-one against Ezekiel. Kevin Owens believes that Ezekiel is really Elias, which can't possibly be true because Elias had a beard, and Ezekiel clearly does not. But Owens has been slowly descending into madness ever since WrestleMania. On Monday, he gave Ezekiel the unintended assist in a six-man tag. He gave Chad Gable an accidental super kick, which led to Ezekiel winning the match for his team. After the show on Raw Talk, Owens absolutely just, he melted down. He lost his mind. It was more entertaining than anything that actually aired on TV. Now, this whole angle is not going to have legs for too much longer, but Owens, he's doing his damnedest to make it entertaining. You know, he goes from losing to Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania to losing to Ezekiel here in this match. Owens is basically bulletproof. It doesn't even really matter if he wins or loses. I think Zeke gets one over on him, and Owens descends even further into madness. You know, if they had given this Ezekiel stuff enough long-term thought, which, I know. But if they did, it would have been funny if they would have recorded something with Elias before he shaved the beard, right? Have him, like, pop up on screen during the match to play a song for Owens on his guitar, and that distracts him, and that leads to him losing. But what are the chances they figured out what the hell they wanted to do with this guy before they told him to shave his face? It's probably not very likely. Bobby Lashley takes on Omos and MVP in a handicap match. This will be their fourth time in the ring together since WrestleMania. Lashley won at Mania. Omos won the rematch at Backlash. And then Lashley won their cage match on Raw before losing to MVP by countout, which gave MVP the chance to pick the stipulation for this match. You know, with Omos, being big will only get you so far. You've seen one Omos match, you've seen them all. He's very limited in what he can do. He's very big. That's his whole shtick. That's why he has a job. He's very big. That will only get you so far. One man they should be protecting right now for a possible championship match with Roman Reigns is Bobby Lashley, who is now a babyface. There is more value in Lashley winning here than there is in putting over the other two. So Lashley wins this. That's my prediction. And I hope we can move on. Question is, you know, where do you even move on to with Omos? You know, all the male champions right now on Raw are heels. Not that I want to see him challenging for any championships. But they're all heels. And so, you know, then what? Where do you go with him? I do have to say, I don't know how many of you watched the NXT show last night. Probably not very many of you. They spliced in ads throughout the show for each of the matches at Hell in a Cell. At least on my version of Peacock they did. On the probably the ad-supported version, they played other commercials. But if you have the kind of the non-ad higher version of Peacock, they play these random WWE video packages sometimes and profile pieces. And anyway, at least on my end, they were showing ads for the individual matches at the pay-per-view. MVP recorded a diss track on Lashley that was really good. He called it Fall Mighty. That was the name of his song. Fall Mighty. This was better than any of the matches Lashley and Omos have had so far. I hope they replay it tonight. It's really well done. He even gets a dig in there about rescuing Bobby from his blonde wife. Austin Theory against Mustafa Ali for the United States Championship. Ali is going for the title in his hometown of Chicago, which doesn't bode well for his chances. His chances in this company haven't boded well for about 6 months now. Ever since they brought him back, he has been booked as an underdog loser. He's always getting his ass kicked, whether it's by Theory or Ciampa or Miz. Ali had a match with Ciampa on Monday that he had to win to qualify for a shot at the U.S. title. A rare championship contenders match that did not involve the challenger having to beat the champion first on TV. I approved of this. Until Theory interfered for the DQ, which led to a match between Theory and Ali. Only this was for the U.S. title, and Theory won the match very quickly. Adam Pearce came out, he said, not so fast. Ali is going to get a rematch, he's going to get a fair fight at Hell in a Cell. Theory is the star on the rise, not Ali. I would be stunned if Ali walks out of Chicago with that title. And frankly, even if he does, I'm sure it would be booked as a fluke win, some kind of roll-up or distraction or some bullshit like that. I mean, look, it would be a good moment, him being in Chicago. People would cheer. I would hope they would cheer, and they would like it, and it would be a nice little moment. I don't really see how that does him any good anyway, though, if you do that kind of finish. Theory retains. It's clear that Ali is back to being a punching bag until either his contract is up or they cut him in the next wave of mass releases. That's his role. That's his role. Hey, at least he's getting TV time, right? That's his role right now. The money is in Theory. He is the star of the future in this company. That's how they're booking him. I think he has the potential to be one of the top stars in this company in the future. I say that even as a fan of Ali's work. It's not about Ali. The real star here is not Ali, it is Austin Theory. He was on Instagram this week teasing a U.S. title match with John Cena at SummerSlam. I'm sure it's just him fucking around, but this month, you know, I was talking about the 25-year anniversary this year of Hell in a Cell, which technically is in October, but this year marks 25 years since the first one. 20 years ago this month, John Cena debuted on WWE television. He walked out on SmackDown. He said, "Ruthless Aggression," right? He wrestled Kurt Angle in that memorable debut that he had. Undertaker shook his hand backstage after the match. That was 20 years ago this month. And Cena has said he wants to come back. There's rumors already that he might be coming back very soon. We could have a John Cena match maybe even at SummerSlam. It's possible. Cena against Theory, whether it's for the U.S. title or not, I don't know about that, but that's a definite possibility. Cena's talked him up on social media. He seems to be a fan of the kid. Theory, I mean, he grew up on John Cena. He, in interviews in the past, has talked about what an influence Cena was on him. So, yeah, you know, maybe he is fucking around on Instagram, but I would not put that out of the realm of possibility that we could be seeing Cena in the ring with Theory very soon. Why not? Why not have him work against the young guy? They're building to be the next John Cena. We already saw Cena in the real big match against Roman Reigns. So if he's going to come back soon to wrestle someone, why not put him in there with somebody new like Theory? We've got Edge, Damian Priest, and Rhea Ripley taking on AJ Styles, Finn Balor, and Liv Morgan. I think, what was it, on TV on Friday, I think they called it Liv Club. Is that what they're calling these three? Liv Club? Ugh. Judgment Day against Bullet Club. AJ Styles has not had much luck against Edge in their first two matches. At WrestleMania, it was the distraction from Damian Priest joining with Edge. That cost him the match. Last month at Backlash, it was Rhea Ripley joining as the newest member. Edge has been teasing another new member and throwing out random names. Everybody from Drew McIntyre to Shinsuke Nakamura, Tommaso Ciampa, Corey Graves, even AJ Styles and Finn Balor. I think tonight will be more of the same with the latest new recruit being revealed and giving Edge and his crew the win. But for AJ Styles this time, I would say the call is coming from inside the house. On Monday, Liv got a win over Rhea, and the Bullet Club crew stood tall. That will not be the case tonight, and I'm going to predict that it will be Finn Balor going heel and joining Judgment Day. AJ goes 0-3 against Edge, and we get at least a couple of matches out of Styles against Balor. I think a heel turn could do Balor some good. I think like Bobby Lashley, AJ Styles, he would be a good name to build up to challenge Roman Reigns at some point, but the timing just doesn't feel right for Edge's group to lose, especially after Ripley already lost her match on Monday. We have Bianca Belair defending her Raw Women's Championship against Becky Lynch and Asuka. Rhea is somebody who should be primed to challenge Bianca for that title next month, but to get there, Bianca has to retain here, and she will. Bianca Belair will retain her Raw Women's title. We should, though, end up with an excellent match out of these three. You know, the original plan was for Naomi to have won that six-pack challenge a few weeks ago and go on to challenge Bianca and lose on this show until she and Sasha walked out. And there's been no update on the whole Sasha and Naomi situation, by the way. So WWE had to move on quickly to a plan B. I'm guessing we would have gotten Becky against Asuka one-on-one with Asuka going over and eventually challenging Bianca in a singles match for the title, which is why I think Becky takes the losing fall in this match. I hated that they had Bianca pin Asuka at the beginning of the show on Monday. Hated that. It's so pointless and counterproductive to do that so close to the pay-per-view. I think Becky takes the losing fall, and we could still get Bianca against Asuka in a singles match again, but this time for the championship. Maybe a Money in the Bank. And Cody Rhodes meets Seth Rollins for the third time, this time inside Hell in a Cell, Cody is 2-0 against Rollins so far, and he should go 3-0 for the clean sweep to make a real statement. Just as Batista beat Triple H 3 straight times in their program in 2005. I keep thinking back to that program. I think Cody should do the same here. He won at WrestleMania. He used Rollins' own cheating tactics against him at Backlash to beat him. Rollins has had his life turned upside down ever since. Right? He's been costing Cody Rhodes matches. He's been turning Cody's life, is what I mean, into a living hell. Cost him the U.S. title in a match against Theory. On Monday, they had one of the better pull-apart brawls that I've seen in a while. They brawled into the crowd. They were separated at ringside only to end up breaking free, and they were fighting again. They couldn't keep these two apart. I even spotted Curtis Axel out there. Apparently, Curtis Axel is one of the new producers behind the scenes in WWE. But it was the best stuff on the show on Monday. That's how you do a hot go-home angle to a major match like this. And I continue to give WWE credit for the way they have booked and presented Cody Rhodes so far. I think you want to be careful with the whole Cody countdown clock and not do that every week. But they have really presented him in the biggest possible way. It's been flawless. I predict another win here for Cody Rhodes. You keep that momentum going as they build him for an eventual championship match, whenever that may be. The idea of him winning Money in the Bank next month is tempting. I keep seeing people throw Cody Rhodes' name around to win the briefcase. I don't think he needs it. And if he does win it, there's absolutely no way that he should be cashing in on Roman Reigns unannounced, you know, after a match. That's not the right story to tell. It doesn't fit Cody's character right now on TV. It just doesn't work. If he wins Money in the Bank, he needs to call his shot in advance, not sneak attack the champion. But that's still a ways off. I don't think Cody's getting his shot in the near future. But there's one other prediction I want to make about this match for what I think happens after the match. If I'm right, and it plays into the finish, then Cody loses. But they could just as easily have Cody win and then have the lights go out and have this person show up after the match is over. And that is the return of Bray Wyatt. He was suddenly very vocal on social media this week. He tweeted, "I'm tired of watching, tired of hearing irrelevant clowns speculate how I'll be perceived, tired of hearing about my greed, my desire questioned. Wherever and whenever I decide to return, I will remind everybody why they know my name, again and again. Believe in me." Then in another tweet, he said, "Patience, it's almost time." Last time we saw Bray in a ring was last year's WrestleMania. And then last summer, they fired him. One of the most shocking of all the cuts, given how big of a name and how big of a merch seller he was for them. And a few months later, these reports all of a sudden began to leak, intentionally, from people within the company, no doubt, about Bray being outspoken about poor booking decisions and that he deserved to be fired. There were people in the company who believed that Bray basically was annoying and deserved to be fired. These were things that he himself, in reacting to it on social media, suggested were being leaked by Bruce Pritchard and John Laurinaitis, two men who still work there and wield great power in that company. You consider that, you consider the way they completely fucked over that Fiend character, the way they fired him, you would ask the question, why the hell would he go back? Because there's no other logical place for him to go. I'm sure Impact would love to have him if they could afford him. Tony Khan has spoken kindly of him in the past. I'm sure Tony would be willing to work with him as well at some point in the future. I mean, it's not as if he doesn't have any options. But logically speaking, where is he going to go right now? AEW doesn't need him. AEW is right at about their limit when it comes to signing people, whether they're from WWE or not. I mean, we see it with people like Malakai and Andrade. They don't get much time on television. There just aren't very many spots to go around right now. And I don't think somebody like Bray Wyatt, under whatever name he would come in under, Wyndham or whatever he calls himself, I don't think he would be the best fit right now for AEW. I don't think that would be a good idea. Where else is he going to go? The betting odds have to be that if he wants to get back into the ring and back on TV in a major way, it's going to be in WWE. They could use another name player more than AEW can at this point. And it's not like people haven't been fired before and cut before from WWE, and then 6 months later or a year later, they bring them back. But what intrigues me, and the reason I think there's a good chance we do see him tonight, isn't because Seth Rollins is back inside the cell. And Bray Wyatt has a history with Seth Rollins, and we all know that, especially inside the cell. A history that I would just as soon like to forget. The worst Hell in a Cell match of all time. It's not about Seth, though. It's about Cody. There's a history between Cody Rhodes and Bray Wyatt. And you heard a little bit of that actually at the beginning of the podcast in that clip that I played. Cody was Bray's pro for NXT Season 2, back when Bray first came up as Husky Harris. One of the other things Bray did this week on social media was he changed his profile picture. He changed it to a butterfly with the Fiend's face on. If you look closely, you can make out that the Fiend's head, the Fiend's face, is on the butterfly. But the butterfly thing is interesting. Because 3 years ago, Bray was replying to a fan who tweeted him a Husky Harris gif from an episode of SmackDown when Cody had brought him out to the ring with him. It may have been the first promo that Cody ever did under his new dashing Cody Rhodes gimmick at the time. Bray responded to the fan's tweet, and this was 3 years ago. So this was the same year that AEW started up. Again, Cody wasn't in WWE, Bray was. And he responded to this fan and basically blamed Cody. You know, again, in storyline. He blamed Cody. He wasn't shooting on him or anything. It's all storyline stuff. But he blamed him for mocking him on television in front of the world. He said he was his partner. He trusted him. He said he was ridiculed in front of the world for someone else's failed attempt at fame. It destroyed him. And from his ashes, a butterfly was born. But the memory remains. He said that in 2019. Here we are in 2022. Cody Rhodes is back. Bray is teasing his next big move and posting butterfly pictures on his account. There were major issues with the way he was used last time. But WWE is still, I think, the likeliest place for him to land. And what better time than now with Cody on top? So those are my Hell in a Cell predictions. Join me live. I will be on YouTube. You're getting two podcasts today, not just one. I'll be live on YouTube as soon as the show is over for the full review. We'll break it all down. So stop by, even if you're not watching the pay-per-view. I don't care. You can watch me instead of the pay-per-view. Last Sunday at Double or Nothing, CM Punk beat Hangman Adam Page to win the AEW World Heavyweight title. His first championship in almost a decade. And then on Dynamite Wednesday night, he asked for someone from New Japan to step up and face him in Chicago. And the ace, Hiroshi Tanahashi, came out to answer the challenge for the Forbidden Door pay-per-view. The very term originally coined by Tanahashi himself 2 years ago when he wrestled Chris Jericho at Wrestle Kingdom. And he said that if he beat Jericho, he would break the Forbidden Door. He would break down the door and come to America to challenge Jericho again, but this time for Jericho's AEW World title. Of course, Tanahashi did not win. But the stage was set after Wednesday for Punk to ride into his hometown as champion. This was going to be the summer of Punk. That's all anybody was talking about after Wednesday. Here we go again. We had one in Ring of Honor. We had one in WWE. And now AEW would have its own summer of Punk. Well, the summer of Punk is canceled. Instead, it's looking like the fall of Punk. Actually, it was the fall of Punk this week. That's why we're in this mess to begin with. I knew we were getting bad news on Friday when Punk tweeted out, about 2 hours before Rampage went live, that he would be on the show. He was not originally advertised for the show. All of a sudden, he went on social media. He said he was going to have an important announcement about the AEW World title and his future and his career. And I thought, uh-oh. That sounds ominous. And when he limped to the ring, he had tears in his eyes. It was pretty obvious. I mean, he's not that good of an actor. It was pretty obvious that this was not some sort of angle or swerve. He said he got to the building and every bone in his body told him to turn around and go home to his family, even the broken ones. He said he had good news and bad news. The bad news is he's injured and he needs surgery. A couple of things were broken, he said, the biggest being his heart. Because he wanted to go on one hell of a run as the AEW World Champion. The good news is that he said he could still do that. He said the wheels haven't fallen completely off yet. It's just that one of them happens to be broken. And he said that he told Tony Khan he doesn't want to hold this place up. There's the laundry list of men who could be champion, and he named Bryan Danielson and Jon Moxley as two examples. Two ex-WWE guys. MJF was right. But he said the get back is going to be bigger than the setback. He's going to come back bigger, faster, stronger, and hungrier than ever before, and he'll prove why he is the best in the world. He didn't say how or when the injury happened. He didn't need to. Go back and watch his entrance at the start of Dynamite on Wednesday. He was smiling. He had the title around his waist. He was so happy. He was moving around just fine. Until he dove into the crowd. He did another stage dive, just like the one he did at the first dance when he debuted last summer. Only this time, it looked like his leg struck the top part of the guardrail on the landing. And when he came back up and he was walking down to the ring with FTR for their trios match, he looked down at his leg like something was wrong and he was noticeably limping. That would explain some of the sloppiness we saw in the match where he slipped on the springboard clothesline into the ring and he threw a drop kick at one of Billy Gunn's boys that missed by a mile. He didn't look right. He didn't look right at all. He botched a couple of Buckshot Lariat attempts at the pay-per-view also, but that's a hard move to pull off. I don't even know why he was trying that in the first place. It's not his move. But when this was over, on Wednesday, when the trios match was over, he mouthed something to Dax Harwood, like he knew he was hurt. He knew something was wrong. And when he came back out after the MJF segment, which I'm going to get into, this part didn't air on TV, but he limped down to the ring before MJF ultimately bailed into the crowd and left the building. He wasn't even wearing a boot or a shoe or a sock on the injured foot. So after this great comeback story that they have told with Punk, after 7 years away, he makes this triumphant return and gets that amazing reaction at the United Center in Chicago last August. One of the loudest ovations I've ever heard anybody get, right? It's up there and it's in that top five, top three category. Wrestled Darby Allin. He had that great feud with MJF. I mean, they didn't waste any time. They went right into it. Him and MJF, that was great. And now here we are, all these months later, and he wins the big one, right? He finally wins it. They've got this match set up in his hometown later this month against Tanahashi. And it's on a stupid dive into the crowd that he breaks his foot. Now, whatever your thoughts are on Punk, you don't have to be a Punk fan. I mean, look, I think that was incredibly stupid. You know, of course, hindsight looking back, why the fuck would you do that? That was very stupid of him. But I don't like to see anybody get hurt. I'm not going to mock the guy. I'm not going to celebrate the fact that he got hurt, even though there's some, you know, a bunch of dumbasses on social media that were doing it. The biggest one, of course, being Ryback. Didn't stop him from taking pleasure in the injury on his Twitter. He said, "Karma rules," he said, with a little emoji. Punk has had some unkind comments about Ryback in the past, as he claimed Ryback was unsafe to work with and that Ryback hurt him. That's what he claims. But you know, for somebody who loves to preach positivity and that people need to be nicer to each other, that's like Ryback's new gimmick. That's his new shtick. This is the same man who called Vince McMahon's dead mother a whore only a few weeks ago and once said that the world would be a better place with Dave Meltzer 6 feet under. I see Ryback believes in the idea of rules for me, not for thee. Do as I say, not as I do. But mass confusion followed this segment on Friday night. Chris Jericho was on commentary on Rampage, and more than once he said that Punk had just relinquished the AEW World title. In fact, he has not relinquished the AEW World title. He is not being stripped of the championship. He will remain the AEW champion while he recovers. And instead, AEW is going to crown an interim world champion. Now, I understand they only found out late afternoon on Friday that Punk would need surgery and they were scrambling, but the way they handled this was a complete fucking mess. Everybody was confused by the time that show was over. There was just, when that show was over, everybody was asking, wait a minute, what is he the champion? Is he not the champion? What are they doing? Tanahashi wasn't mentioned. Is he still part of this? Nobody knew anything. It would have been very simple to tell people to follow AEW social media for an announcement in the coming days or the next day about how and when a new champion would be crowned. And then hash out the details instead of just confusing the shit out of everybody. Excalibur announced that per Tony Khan, a battle royal will open Dynamite this Wednesday with the winner meeting number one ranked Jon Moxley at the end of the show. And the winner of that match will go on to Forbidden Door to challenge for the interim AEW world title. That only added to the confusion because the rankings had not yet been updated on their website and Moxley was ranked at number four. Which is why I said if they would have just waited an extra 24 hours, they could have sorted through all of this and told people, stay tuned to our social media for a special announcement on Saturday about how we're going to handle things. By then, they had posted new rankings that had Moxley in the top spot. It's not usually a day that they post the new rankings, so it kind of just looks like they changed them to fit whatever story they wanted to tell. Tony Khan went on Twitter. He tried to explain why Moxley was getting a match with the Battle Royal winner by saying that Moxley is the only AEW wrestler with 7 singles matches this year, all undefeated, on TV. He said Anthony Ogogo is the only other undefeated man on the roster this year to go 7-0. How the fuck did that happen? Yeah, wrestling on Dark every week. Yeah, let's put Anthony Ogogo in there against Tanahashi. Let's do that. But he said, Ogogo is the only other one that has a comparable record, but Moxley ranked higher based on the quality of opponents. Because they do factor that in. That's what they claim. It's the quality of your wins. It's the quality of your competition that counts. So technically, Anthony Ogogo could have racked up 25 straight wins on Dark. Beating people like fucking JD Drake and Ryan Nemeth week after week. He can go 25-0, and Moxley would still get the match because he is wrestling people of a higher caliber. So yesterday they put out a press release attempting to explain everything. This is what they've come up with. This should have been a very simple announcement. Either have a battle royal with the winner becoming the interim champion, or take the number one ranked star and put them in a match with the number two ranked star. The winner is either the interim champion or the winner goes on to Forbidden Door to wrestle Tanahashi. Since Tanahashi already called his shot on Wednesday, when Punk came out, you know, to ask for somebody to step up. So you could do that. Instead, they're doing a world title eliminator series, starting with this battle royal. I understand them doing a battle royal and not a tournament. We just came off two tournaments. Literally, we just crowned winners in two Owen Hart single elimination tournaments. So I understand not wanting to go back to a tournament so soon. So they're going to do a battle royal. The winner meets Moxley at the end of the show, and the winner goes to the pay-per-view on June 26th. Then on June 12th, which is next weekend, next Sunday, at the New Japan Dominion show in Osaka, Tanahashi is going to wrestle Hirooki Goto, and the winner of that match will go on to Forbidden Door to wrestle the winner of the match between Moxley and the Battle Royal winner. Then, when Punk is ready to come back, he and the interim champion will meet to determine the undisputed AEW world champion. I don't like the interim stuff. I know why they do it. They do it in UFC. Tony is a big UFC guy. And look, there are certain situations where it might make sense and it could set up a really big match when the champion comes back. If you've got, you know, big enough names, champion against champion, there could be some appeal there depending on who the champions are. They already did this once this year with Cody Rhodes and Sammy Guevara for the TNT title. Cody missed a week. Maybe 2 weeks at the most is what he missed. It was completely unnecessary. But they did it because they wanted to set up that ladder match for TV. Punk is going to miss more than 2 weeks, but I don't think he's going to be gone very long. Depending on how bad of a break it is, right? Because we don't know yet. He may not be gone that long. I would just strip him of the title, and then the story when he gets back is in the chase to get his belt back. I was never beat. I never lost. Instead, they're doing the interim thing. I'm not going to beat them up over the Battle Royal, like I said. I understand them not wanting to do a tournament, but I also understand doing it this way with the Battle Royal and the match with Moxley. Look, they just lost their world champion. It sucks. The timing on that could not be any worse. They just lost their biggest draw in CM Punk. And they're trying to put together some matches to promote for television to get people hooked into watching. They're trying to drive interest in Dynamite. You announce a big match to open the show. Hopefully you get people tuned in at the beginning. And then at the end, you throw that Moxley match in there to get them to either come back for the end or hopefully stick around for the full 2 hours. Having Tanahashi wrestle Goto at Dominion first, I'm fine with that. Even though there's no chance Goto wins, it gives New Japan an extra match on their show that carries some importance now. Maybe New Japan requested it. Maybe they said, hey, you know, maybe we can have a match on our show. And, you know, and what's Tony Khan going to say? No. You know, he wants to make nice with Ghetto and New Japan and say, yeah, why don't we do this? That way we have our own matches that we can feature. You have a match that you can feature. And it all ties together. Right? Because when you have a partnership like this, sometimes both sides want something. So I don't know what the politics of this may have been behind the scenes on that. I don't mind them doing Tanahashi against Goto. Predictable as it may be, I don't mind it. And the most likely opponent for Tanahashi is Jon Moxley. Moxley has been calling out Tanahashi for months. Months. It's the match that makes the most sense. If we are ranking these on a scale of most likely to least likely, Moxley against Tanahashi is the most likely outcome here, with Moxley winning the championship. If I knew that Tanahashi was going to be sticking around for a while, I'd put it on Tanahashi. And that way we still get Punk against Tana when Punk gets back, but they've got the G1 starting next month. And if Tanahashi wins the title and takes it back to Japan with him, then what the fuck is the point of even having an interim champion? Why are you going to put the title on Hiroshi Tanahashi and then he goes back to Japan and you don't have your champion around for your television shows? That defeats the whole purpose of crowning an interim champion. So again, unless Tanahashi is foregoing the G1 this year and he's going to stick around for a couple of months, whoever wrestles him, we know Tanahashi isn't winning. So then you look at the Battle Royal. We don't know who's in the Battle Royal. They have not announced any names for the Battle Royal as of the moment I am recording this. That could change, you know, by Monday morning. But right now we don't know who is in the Battle Royal. But I put together a short list here. Bryan Danielson. Bryan Danielson winning and then beating Jon Moxley, his fellow Blackpool Combat Club comrade, and then wrestling Tanahashi would be excellent. And then we have Danielson against CM Punk when Punk is ready to come back. Every time somebody asks CM Punk, he did it again at the media scrum last Sunday. Every time somebody asks Punk, who do you want to get into the ring with? Looking forward now, you're the champion. Who do you look forward? Who are you excited the most to step into the ring with? Every single time he gets asked this question, Bryan Danielson is always the first name that he mentions. He is dying to get back into the ring with him. It's been 10 years since we last saw them in the ring together. I would like to see that again. So you can't go wrong with Bryan Danielson. What about Wardlow? Wardlow's coming off the biggest win of his career, a Double or Nothing. The poor bastard, I mean, he's been completely overshadowed by everything else that happened this week. I mean, we're going to talk about MJF here in a second, but my God, there's Wardlow on television on Wednesday wrestling fucking, I think it was JD Drake. And then starting a feud with Smart Mark Sterling. Boy, I don't know about this. I don't know about where they're headed with Wardlow, but boy, it seems like he's already sliding down the mountain here. Wardlow winning the Battle Royal would make sense, gives him a big win. And even if he goes on and loses to Moxley, which he would, it's not that big of a deal because you could say, well, you know, he was in a Battle Royal, right? Maybe there's some kind of interference, Smart Mark, again, maybe he gets involved, but you could have Wardlow win the Battle Royal and then go on to lose in the main event at the end of the night. Could very well do that. Adam Cole. Adam Cole could win the Battle Royal. Adam Cole could wrestle Jon Moxley at the end of the night. I think it's very unlikely that Cole would beat Moxley and he would get the Tanahashi match. But it's at least possible. Eddie Kingston. Eddie Kingston's a big fan favorite. I already see people, put the title, put the interim title on Eddie Kingston. Eddie Kingston and CM Punk have history together. They've already feuded on TV once. Eddie Kingston becoming the interim champion. What a great feel-good story that would be. And then you got the match or the rematch with him and Punk when Punk comes back, and obviously Punk would win and, you know, he'd be the undisputed champion. To me, you know, again, it doesn't work. I don't think it works right now. Kingston's focus is Chris Jericho and his group. We're going into Blood and Guts, which has been made official for Dynamite on June 29th. That's 3 days after the Forbidden Door show. I cannot see them removing Eddie Kingston from that match. I cannot see them putting the championship on Eddie Kingston and him just continuing on with this Jericho feud. Time-wise, I don't think it really makes a whole lot of sense. What about Miro? Miro just returned on television on Wednesday after 6 months away. Maybe Miro wins the Battle Royal, and then he falls to Moxley at the end of the show. Hangman Page is already wrestling David Finlay from New Japan on Dynamite on Wednesday, so I assume Hangman isn't even going to be in the Battle Royal, although he would have a claim because he was the most recent champion. But it doesn't look like he's going to be a part of this. So all of these are viable options, some more than others. But there's another option. And it's the one that if Tony Khan really wants to get people talking and really wants to capitalize on all of the buzz from this week, instead of the Summer of Punk, he will give us the Summer of MJF. MJF lost to Wardlow last Sunday at Double or Nothing. There was a lot of controversy coming into that show because he had no-showed a FanFest signing on Saturday. Nobody could get a hold of him. There was a supposed flight back to New Jersey that was booked that people thought he was going to get on the flight and no-show the pay-per-view. That ended up not happening. He showed up, he did business, and he went out on a stretcher. He comes out on television on Wednesday. Now, in a perfect world, he wouldn't have been on television on Wednesday. He wouldn't be on television for at least a month, licking his wounds after the loss. 10 power bombs at the hands of Wardlow. That was the one negative about the MJF stuff on the show on Wednesday, is that he walked out there, he made one passing comment about how he was still in a lot of pain. But after he said that, you would look at him, you would listen to him, you would never know it. You would never know that he was in pain. You would never know that he got powerbombed 10 fucking times by Wardlow at Double or Nothing and went out on a stretcher, even though they put the oxygen mask over his fucking eyes. They did a stretcher job, and then boom, he was right back on TV on Wednesday. That was not good. But he came out and he said, I'm not here tonight to talk to you people as MJF. I'm here to talk to you as Max Friedman. And he mentioned that all the Warner and Discovery executives that were in the building, because they threw a big party when the show was over at the Forum on Wednesday for AEW, big mixer. He said, boy, it'd be a real shame if something bad happened here tonight with all these executives watching. He said when AEW started, it was all friends wrestling, but not for him, right? Nobody knew who he was. He had to earn his way to the top. He had to earn people's respect. He said everything he touches turns to gold. When he comes out every week, he's not expected to hit home runs. He's expected to hit grand slams, and he does it. Other wrestlers settle for being great. He has to be perfect. He's 26 years old. He says he's the only guy who's capable of carrying this company on his back is me. He said, you know, it's funny that I hear clapping mixed in with the boos that he was getting from the crowd. He goes, where were all you people when I was being called an unprofessional piece of shit this weekend? And all the boys in the back, they want my spot. Well, you know what? They can have it because I don't want to be here anymore. And then he turned his ire to the fans and called them uneducated marks. And the fans don't know shit. He called himself a generational talent and said that we all take him for granted, but it's not just us. It's the big man in the back. He said he's the biggest minute-by-minute draw that this company has. He goes, if you don't believe me, Stat Boy Tony, he'll tell you. He said Tony Khan hoards all this money just to bring in all these ex-WWE guys. And the fans cheered, and he asked the boss, he goes, hey, maybe you would treat me better if I were a former WWE guy. And he said the problem with Tony Khan is that he has a position of power when the only position that he should be assuming is behind the guardrail with all the marks. He said, I don't want to wait until 2024. He stared right into the camera. He said, Tony, I want you to fire me. And then they censored him, calling Tony Khan a fucking mark, before they cut his mic off and they cut to commercial. So now we're left, you know, wondering, hey, was it all work from the very beginning? Was the whole thing from start to finish? And when I say from the start to finish, I'm talking going back months when these reports first surfaced of there being some unrest and MJF being very frustrated. And the stuff with the interview he gave to Ariel Helwani that supposedly they were upset he didn't clear it with their PR team. Was everything just a work from day one? I don't believe so. I believe they've taken a real situation that was probably played up, you know, bigger maybe than it was, but some real frustrations that I'm sure he had, and they've turned it into a storyline, which is what led to what we saw on Wednesday. The best promos are the ones that blend reality and fiction and play off real emotion. There was a lot of what came out of his mouth on Wednesday that I'm sure he believes, especially when it comes to the ex-WWE guys that Tony Khan's been bringing in and throwing a lot of money at. That in some cases don't do the kind of numbers on TV that MJF segments do. You take that real emotion, you blend it in with, you know, the storyline, whatever the storyline is, and what you end up with is what we had on Wednesday. This was MJF's pipe bomb moment. And I thought he knocked it out of the fucking park. That is a promo segment that we are going to remember and be talking about for a very long time. And it could be a turning point. It should be a turning point for him in his career, much the way that the pipe bomb in Vegas was for Punk back in 2011. Similar situation. CM Punk, 1 foot out the door, contract about to expire, unlike MJF, who's got, you know, 18 months left on his. He's ready to head out the door. He sees the writing on the wall. He knows it's probably not going to get any better for him. He's frustrated. He's able to go out there in a worked shoot and vocalize that. And used that to build up his match with John Cena. It ended up turning him into the biggest star in wrestling. He was white hot that summer. It ended up as the champion. When this segment was over, since then, his merch has been pulled from Shop AEW. He has been removed from the AEW roster page. They've taken him out of the show intros for Dynamite and Rampage. I mean, they're making all these little moves now that they're really leaning into it. And they're really trying to make people convinced that, you know what, this guy, he's not fired. But yeah, he's like in Sasha and Naomi territory right now. He's suspended. He is not to be spoken of. It's like he doesn't even exist. Then this situation develops with CM Punk getting hurt. And they want to crown an interim champion. This all happens to just take place at the same time. The timing for Punk is awful, but the timing for this, for MJF, could not be any better. We talked about the Battle Royal and all the possibilities from Danielson to Miro to Wardlow to Kingston. What about MJF? What about MJF? MJF is not going to come out there and be a regular part of the Battle Royal. MJF is not going to come out there and get music and get an entrance. What if MJF, in his street clothes, comes out at the end of that battle royal, dumps out whoever the last one or two people are, sneaks in and wins the battle royal? He is technically still under contract to AEW. He is still employed. He is not fired. What if he sneaks in and wins the battle royal? Then he goes on to beat Jon Moxley, because there's nothing Tony Khan could do about it, right? He won the battle royal fair and square. He gets his match with Moxley. He wins, possibly with some help from Jericho's crew, because they're still feuding with, you know, Regal's group. So maybe it isn't clean, but he beats Moxley. MJF gets the match with Hiroshi Tanahashi at Forbidden Door, which would be perfect because he has been talking openly about how he doesn't like New Japan. I don't watch it. It's not really for me. I'm not a fan of the product. You know, in that interview he did with Ariel Helwani a few months ago, he said, I'm not a fan of the product, but, you know, if I had to pick a favorite of mine in New Japan, I would go with the Great Okan. The guy knows how to get fucking heat. When you think Great Okan is the best thing New Japan has to offer, fuck you. He knows what he's doing. So there's already a little built-in side story of him not liking and not respecting New Japan and people like Tanahashi. Imagine, you're thinking Great Okan is better than Hiroshi Tanahashi. So it works, and look, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with putting the belt on Jon Moxley. He's one of their biggest stars, people love him, he's been champion before, he's always a reliable hand. He was with WWE. There's a period of time there, he was like the Iron Man in WWE. Other people, other members of the Shield, they went down with injuries, and there was Mox. Right? He's always been that guy. But the thing with that is, it's been done before. He's already been AEW champion. This is a chance for Tony Khan to do something that has not been done before. What better way for MJF to stick it to Tony Khan and give him a nice big fuck you than going on to become the interim AEW world champion? He can hold the title hostage, basically, until Punk returns. It'll make all of his segments on television must-see, and the champion, the current interim champion, would be the biggest star on the show and the most interesting part of the show. Which is something that really I think Hangman Page suffered a great deal from. I'm not as down on Hangman Page and his run looking back on it as AEW champion as some people are. I think he had some great matches. I think his promos improved there towards the end. But in terms of his positioning on the show, he was not the most important player on the show. And he was the champion. And that should never happen. So no, he did not have the greatest run as champion. You wouldn't have that issue here with MJF. He'd be the hottest thing on the show. And it would put him on a collision course with CM Punk. Champion against champion when Punk comes back. It could be a role reversal from 2011 with MJF as the rebellious one this time, threatening to take the title anywhere he wants to. With Punk in the old John Cena role. But they don't have to copy exactly what WWE did. This doesn't have to be them copying WWE. We could end up with Punk as the heel at the end of all this. There are some very interesting roads to potentially go down here. But in 1 week, they have turned MJF into the most talked about thing in wrestling. Now is the time to lean into that and not put him on the back burner. Even if it interrupts whatever plan they had for this. Injuries happen. Plans change. You need to be able to adjust. Tony Khan needs to read the room and see that there is money to be made here. And this isn't an ex-WWE guy that we're talking about. This is one of the young pillars of his company. The timing could not be any better. Moxley might be the safest, most predictable choice, but MJF is the best choice. Now, Tony Khan, he had quite the night after Double or Nothing last Sunday. Just to take it back to the pay-per-view for a minute. Since I didn't get a chance to really react to this, because when I was live on YouTube at fucking 1 o'clock in the morning, first starting my review of a very long night of AEW action, he was having this meltdown at the post-show scrum. So they have all these people who come to the scrums, and of course, you know, they're asking... there are a lot of softball questions. This is not a traditional, you know, press event or press conference. It's not like what you would find in any actual sport. It is what it is. But he's sitting there next to CM Punk. And somebody asked him about Eric Bischoff's comments. Because Bischoff was on his podcast recently talking about what a financial flop CM Punk has been. And Tony Khan did not miss a beat. He interjected and said, that's fucking bullshit. And he went off and completely melted down. To the point where CM Punk, it was more entertaining to watch CM Punk's face and his facial expressions throughout this entire thing. On the one hand, he seemed to enjoy having his ego stroked. On the other hand, it got to the point where even Punk had to stop Tony Khan and kind of save him from himself and say, okay, let's move on. Because he wouldn't shut up, and he was going on and on, citing all of these stats, you know, the first dance in Chicago and the Friday Night War. And I'm like, wait a minute, the Friday Night what? What is he talking about? It was the one night when they competed against each other, and you had SmackDown, I think, on FS1, and they extended it to where they were competing with Rampage, and I think AEW won the demo that night. And look, that was a big feather in their cap because, you know, the demo is obviously important. No one's saying it isn't. And no other wrestling company has been able to come along and do that. But it was one night. But he was talking about it, like the Friday Night War, like it was some kind of drawn out conflict, the war of fucking 1812 or something here. I'm like, but he's going on and he's dropping fucking cuss bombs after cuss bombs. I mean, I do here too, but this guy was just throwing them out there like they were going out of style. Fuck this, bullshit that, goddamn this, goddamn that, over and over and over again. I'm thinking, boy, you know, I wonder if Martha Hart is standing off to the side, or maybe some of those Warner executives are also standing off to the side watching this going, holy shit, this is the guy that we're going to have to work with. I mean, it wasn't even worthy of him going off in that way. I thought it was entertaining in kind of a very like train wreck kind of way. But it definitely did not warrant that kind of response. Eric Bischoff does not warrant that kind of response. People like Eric Bischoff, Ryback, I mentioned him a little while ago. I mentioned him, I moved on. They don't warrant more than a few words. And I like the comment that CM Punk made when Tony finally settled down, because it was kind of embarrassing. And Punk interjected in a very calm, rational way and said, people like that should just kind of die in the dark. Which is not meant to be taken literally. It's an expression meaning let them shout into the void, ignore them, pay them no attention, and eventually you don't give them oxygen, they die out. And I think there's a lot to be said when it comes to letting certain people in instances like that who are just looking to, you know, create controversy for their own podcast or whatever, let them die in the dark. Sometimes it's not even worth it to give them oxygen. But Tony Khan, I mean, clearly that was building up within him for a while. And I think on the one hand, it's nice of him sticking up for his champion and defending him. But, I mean, you talk about going way over the top with it and taking it too far. I mean, that was not his finest moment. But there was a rumor also this week, and it was attributed to Meltzer and The Observer, and it was bullshit. I don't know. Somebody made it up, but it ended up circulating and people took it that this is something Dave Meltzer said, that we were going to get Okada against Hangman at Forbidden Door. Apparently that is not true. Look, maybe they changed their mind and they end up doing it, but apparently that is not the plan. It never was the plan to do Hangman against Okada. It wouldn't be the first time that match has happened, though, if it does. Their G1 match, they had a G1 match a few years ago that had one of the best buckshot lariats I have ever seen. From Hangman Page. Maybe the best. He did it. He was in the crowd. Okada was on the floor. Hangman was over the barrier in the crowd. And he did the flip dive that he does on the buckshot. Over the guardrail. Off the guardrail. Landed on his feet. And then wrecked him with the lariat. It was fucking a thing of beauty. So Okada against Hangman would be a hell of a match. But it doesn't look like that's the plan for Forbidden Door. If Bryan Danielson is not in the Battle Royal, or if he is, but he doesn't win it, what about Okada against Danielson? You know, Danielson against Zack Sabre Jr., yes, that would be a lot of fun. But, you know, if Bryan isn't wrestling for the interim title, the biggest possible match I think they could do, or co-main event, would be Okada against Danielson. That's the match. At some point, we've got to get that match. I don't even care if it's here, if it's in Japan. Hopefully by then they're allowed to cheer and boo. Supposedly, that might be lifted as soon as this week. Because in Japan, because of the COVID restrictions and stuff, you can only clap like seals. There's no cheering and booing, but it looks like that might be changing. So fingers crossed, that might be changing soon. It's the only reason why Danielson's been hesitant to go over to Japan. He's been waiting. He's been waiting so that people could cheer. Per Fightful, Dolph Ziggler was backstage visiting at Dynamite. Probably to see his brother. His brother obviously works for AEW. And per Matt Hardy on his podcast, Jeff Hardy got concussed early in their Double or Nothing match against the Young Bucks last Sunday and has no memory of the match. Now, I watched it back. The only thing I could think of is there was a spot early in the match where Jeff went for a poetry in motion in the corner, and Nick Jackson was out on the apron, and he caught him pretty good with a kick to the head. And it was after that Jeff looked like maybe he was a little light on his feet. I know his boot also came untied, and so his boot was loose, and I thought that was why he was moving slower and was a little, you know, a little hesitant on certain moves, but apparently he was concussed. And nobody knew, or else I would like to think they would have stopped the fucking match and at least got him out of there. But he apparently has no memory of the match. Yeah, Jeff Hardy's had a rough week. But you know what would make his week even worse? Finding out that hackers got access to his personal information. You know, Jeff's mind is probably mush at this point. You think he can remember the passwords for all of his accounts? He's got to write them down. Or type them up and save them somewhere. He'd prevent all of that, though, if he was using ExpressVPN. You know, using the internet without ExpressVPN, it's kind of like Brock Lesnar or AJ Styles wrestling without a cup, which has been a real problem for them in the past. You might get out of the match unscathed. You might be okay. Chances are, though, you're going to end up on your knees, writhing in pain. It's always better to be safe than sorry, especially when it is as simple as using ExpressVPN. When you're away from home and you connect to an unencrypted network, your online data, it isn't safe. It doesn't matter if it's an airport, a hotel, a restaurant. Your data is not secure. Any hacker can steal your personal data. ExpressVPN creates almost an impenetrable force field around you and your data. It would take that same hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. And even though we'll all be dead by then, at least your personal data will still be safe. ExpressVPN works on all of your devices, from your phone to your laptop to your tablet, even your smart TV. I run it on my laptop when I'm web browsing. I have the app installed on my phone, also mainly for when I'm away from home. And I love it because of how easy it is to use. I like to say that it's idiot-proof. All you do is fire up the app, you click one button, and that's it. You hit that button and you're protected. It's that easy. When I'm on the web making purchases or doing anything that involves, you know, secure transactions, it gives me that little bit of extra peace of mind knowing my information is safe. And I know a lot of you were having issues with Bleacher Report last week ordering the AEW pay-per-view. I think Fight TV, they may be cutting down on people using their VPN to access the streams that way, but there are other events on other providers. If you're ever having issues ordering a show in this country or getting one to work for you where you are, ExpressVPN, I'm just saying, could be very helpful, could be very useful when it comes to getting you access for even cheaper than what it's going to cost you in your own country to some of these events. I'm not telling you you have to do anything. I'm just saying it comes in very handy having ExpressVPN when you can connect to dozens of servers all over the world to spoof your location. It's a nice little companion to have. Get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN free at expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. One last time, expressvpn.com/solomonster. Some other news and notes. We have seen WWE play hot potato with championships before, right? In the past, they hot shot certain things, titles bounce from one person to the other. Not usually with people, though. We talk about hot potato with objects and titles and things of that nature, not with other human beings, but that is what they are doing with Lacey Evans. She has once again been moved. This woman's got more moves than a Rubik's Cube. They spent weeks airing these inspirational vignettes for her, promoting her return on SmackDown, and then one week, she walked out live in front of the crowd after being given this very bizarre heel-like introduction by the ring announcer, and then she was moved over to Monday Night Raw without any explanation. Never wrestled a match on SmackDown, had all those weeks of vignettes. They had to condense that down for the people who watch Raw. And she made one appearance in the ring for a promo. Her in-ring debut was advertised for Monday's show, and then she just never showed up. She wasn't there. Now, she has been moved back to SmackDown, where, according to PW Insider, she is expected to be a heel. We already got the commercial on Friday for the inspirational Lacey Evans returning to SmackDown this Friday night. Until they change their mind again and they decide to send her back to NXT. And then ultimately to the unemployment line. These people are just making it up as they go along. I'm sure the move back to SmackDown has something to do with Sasha Banks and Naomi walking out and scuttling whatever plans they had for Sasha and Ronda. But how do you explain the first move then, from SmackDown to Raw? You can't put all of this on Sasha and Naomi. They hadn't walked out yet the first time that she was moved. That didn't make much sense to begin with. Both shows could use more names in the women's division, but SmackDown could use her more, so why move her to Raw in the first place? So now she's been moved again, all without wrestling a single match. They want her as a heel, probably because they've got two babyface women's champions. Bianca's already got an opponent lined up for the summer. That should be Rhea Ripley. But Ronda Rousey is going to need people to play with. We know Natalya is next in line after winning the six-pack challenge on Friday. She's going to get the next shot. They haven't said when. Shayna Baszler is an obvious opponent for Ronda, given their friendship and their history together. There's always the potential Raquel Rodriguez heel turn. And then there's Lacey Evans. You know, we're still a month out from Money in the Bank. If she actually wrestles by then, she has to be the favorite right now, I think, to win the women's briefcase at Money in the Bank. Impact just lost two big names. William Morrissey, the former Big Cass, and New Japan's Jay White, who has been making appearances on Impact off and on for a while now. They're both gone. Morrissey spent about a year there. His appearance on the show this week was his last. He had a match with Wardlow on Dynamite in the build to Double or Nothing, so that could be a sign of where he may be headed next. He's been in the middle of a career resurgence after hitting rock bottom. He had his own personal demons and issues with alcohol, and he was in a really bad place. And he has gotten his life together. He looks to be in the best shape of his life. Impact was a good place for him, I think, to reestablish himself and show what he could bring to the table and that he could be relied upon. I think AEW has enough people. WWE could use him more than AEW can right now. He's got the size that you know they love. In the case of Jay White, PW Insider says it just comes down to scheduling. He's busy enough with his New Japan commitments that there's no way for Impact to use him consistently on TV. So for now, he has no future dates scheduled with the company. He's also wrestling Okada for the IWGP title at Dominion next Sunday. And Melanie Pillman, the widow of the late Brian Pillman and the mother of Brian Pillman Jr., passed away this week at the age of 56. No cause of death was given, but her son said that her death, quote, while unexpected, was not surprising. Her lifestyle choices that dominated the better part of the last 25 years of her life ultimately caught up with her. That interview on Raw with Vince McMahon the night after her husband died was not one of her finer moments. And it was not one of WWE's finer moments. I put the blame more on them than I do her. She didn't come across great on that Dark Side of the Ring special on Brian Pillman, and she was almost completely unrecognizable. When I first looked at her, I said, "Who is that?" When I found out it was Melanie Pillman, I was shocked. After all the years of her doing things, obviously, that she shouldn't be doing, I mean, you could tell that she had, you know, she had seen some shit. But she did say, she said her one wish before she dies is to have her kids not be mad at her anymore. And Pillman Jr. said that he didn't have his dad in his life anymore. And his mom is all that he had left. And he had rekindled his relationship with her. Things looked to be better than they used to be. And he said he was very happy to have a parent still left on this earth. And now that parent is gone. So that's very sad. NXT held its latest In Your House show last night. I thought it was a pretty solid show. I would go in the 6.5 to maybe 7 out of 10 range. Legado del Fantasma and Tony D'Angelo's crew, they have been at war now for weeks. Got some mob wars. The two teams met on Escobar's yacht on Tuesday to discuss their match, and they agreed that the losing team would have to join the opposing team to put an end to this war. So they open the show with this. Tony D and his boys, Stacks and Two Dimes, beat Legato. Joaquin Wilde of Legado del Fantasma, he used Tony D's pipe. Not that one, the one that he carries around with him every week. He used the pipe on Stacks, but Tony D'Angelo used Escobar's brass knuckles on Wilde. So Stacks, who was out, fell on top of Wilde and pinned him. And so per the stipulation, the Legado crew must now join Tony D's mafia family. You know, they're both heel groups, but the fans had really treated Legado as the de facto babyface group in this whole thing. And obviously now this is going to continue with the next chapter of this story. Toxic Attraction retained their women's tag team belts over Caden Carter and Katana Chance. Carter and Chance have been a team for so long now. They've got some pretty good tandem offense, but they never win anything. With them out of the way, though, there aren't a lot of other options for opponents for Gigi and JC, which is why if Roxanne Perez wins the women's breakout tournament on Tuesday over Tiffany Stratton, I think she cashes in not for a title match with Mandy Rose, but a tag team title match, and it's going to be, I think, her and Cora Jade going after the women's tag team titles. Our first of two title changes on this show came in the North American title match between Cameron Grimes and Carmelo Hayes. They had a very good match, and with a little help from Trick Williams, Melo regains the North American title with his leg slice off the top rope. Grimes only had 2 months as the champion, but I have no issue with Melo getting it back and then defending it against Solo Sikoa. Sikoa already told Cameron Grimes, hey, you know, I got next. And Grimes agreed. He said, yep, after I win it in your house, you get the next shot. Well, Carmelo Hayes never made that promise. So now watch him tell Sikoa, sorry, buddy, you get no shot. You got to get back in line. And they make Solo Sikoa earn his way to a championship match. Grimes has cooled off a lot in recent months. You know, he's still popular with the fans, but not to the level that he had been like in the feud with LA Knight. He's cooled off a lot. I still feel like under the right circumstances, he could be a great underdog babyface on the main roster. If I trusted them not to look at him and just write him off because he's too small. And, you know, Carmelo Hayes isn't a big guy either. And he's got loads of talent, but even somebody like Carmelo Hayes, who should be a can't-miss prospect, I think it's going to be a challenge for him based purely on his size. Mandy Rose retained her NXT Women's Championship over Wendy Chu. I am not a fan of the gimmick, but Chu had her working chews on here. This was a better match than I expected it to be, just based on the build-up. The build-up to this has been fucking terrible. But they went out there and they had probably, I don't know if it's the best or one of the best Mandy Rose matches that she has had since winning the title. The right outcome, though, with Mandy going over, I'm thinking maybe we see Ivy Nile from Diamond Mine go after the title next. The Creed Brothers finally did it. They are the new NXT Tag Team Champions with a win over Pretty Deadly in the match of the night. Roderick Strong had put them on notice on Tuesday and said that if you don't win these titles, you're out of Diamond Mine. The Creeds had their parents, Mama Creed and Papa Creed, in the front row watching. At one point, when Julius got possession of one of the tag belts, one of the Pretty Deadly guys had tried to use the belt. And Julius got his hands on it. He was going to use it. He thought about using the title. And they showed his dad in the crowd shaking his head like, don't do it, son. Don't take the easy way out, son. So he didn't do it. Julius hit a picture-perfect shooting star press and then immediately popped right back up. And he hit Wilson with his basement lariat for the win. Win the tag team titles. Imagine if Brock Lesnar had hit that shooting star press as perfectly as Julius did here at WrestleMania against Kurt Angle. That would have gone down as one of the greatest finishes in WrestleMania history. Instead, he's just lucky to be able to walk today and not be rolling around in a wheelchair. But this has been a long time coming. The Creeds are one of the best acts on the entire show. They're a great team. I love their fire. I love their passion. They consistently have good matches. There are moments where you could tell they're still green, but they go out there and they largely have very good matches. WWE is said to be very high on Julius in particular and his future as a single star. We'll see if Roddy takes issue on Tuesday with them looking to their dad as more of a mentor than him. You know, we've seen Roderick Strong interfere in their matches before, trying to give them a cheap win, take the easy way out. Maybe he takes issue with them taking their dad's advice over his and not taking the shortcut. Because I'm sure that even though they won, the issues with them and Roddy, they're going to persist. I'm sure this is not over. And, you know, I hadn't seen much of Pretty Deadly from their NXT UK run. I know they were the champions over there. But I have to give them their props, too. You know, they're also a very good team. But they were never meant to be long-term tag team champions. They only got the belts because they had to get them off MSK. When Nash Carter got fired, they had just won the tag team titles back. So they had to come up with a plan B very quickly, get the belts onto someone else. And because the Creeds were in line to eventually get the belts, it only made sense to put them on a heel team. And so I think with them, it was more, you know, right place, right time. But they deserve credit for the match also. Both teams are very good. And Bron Breakker is still the NXT champion. He beat Joe Gacy in a match where if Breakker got disqualified, he would lose his title. This feud has sucked. And I'm glad that it appears to be over. Because Bron Breakker feels less special now than he did when he won the title. The match itself was fine. Definitely not main event worthy, but there was one spot where they had me for a split second. They had me convinced they might actually change the title. Gacy did the Eddie Guerrero spot where he smashed the mat with a chair. He dropped down. The referee turned around and he was about to disqualify Braun. He thought Braun had used the chair. And he was about to call the match a DQ. Another referee ran in and stopped him. But through all of this commotion that was going on, Braun was distracted. Gacy rolled him up with a deep cradle. And I thought he got him. But he kicked out. And Braun speared Gacy off the apron. And Gacy took a hellacious bump onto the announce table. He probably hasn't taken a bump like that since his CZW days. The Druids, the fucking Druids, they tried to interfere at the end. Braun hit one of them with a chair instead of hitting Gacy. Gacy was trying to bait him into hitting him with a chair so he would get DQ'd. He didn't take the bait. Gacy went for his handstand finish, he does the thing like Jay Lethal does when he hits the ropes for the lethal injection. When Gacy came off the ropes and turned around, Breakker absolutely destroyed him with a spear. That was awesome. That was a fantastic spear. Bron Breakker has quickly won me over with that spear. He has got the best looking, spear off the ropes in the business since Goldberg. The best spear since Goldberg. Better than Roman Reigns, better than Edge, better than anybody else I can think of. It just looks tremendous. And then he finished him off with his Gorilla Press Power Slam finish. I thought since Carmelo Hayes lost the North American title a couple months ago that they were getting him ready for a program with Bron Breakker. He could challenge for the top title. But then Melo won the belt back on this show. So I don't know who they go with next for Bron. Knowing them, they'll probably go with Von Wagner. But the champions right now in NXT are Bron Breakker, Carmelo Hayes, the Creed Brothers, and Toxic Attraction. All of them can be stars outside of NXT. How many of them will be? I think it'll be hard to screw up Bron Breakker, but they've had him fighting Druids for the past month, so it's not like they haven't tried. But they've got a good core. They've got a good core of talent there. They also announced the Great American Bash episode of NXT will be taking place on Tuesday, July 5th. I caught the latest Broken Skull Sessions, as I do all of them. It's my favorite of all the original WWE shows they have on Peacock. Like the others before it, I enjoyed this one. I thought it was very good. Steve Austin had Jeff Jarrett on as his guest. Jarrett just started in his new gig in WWE this week as the Senior Vice President of Live Events. That was not mentioned here. But they covered some key topics from his career, his first departure from the company in 95, his return from WCW and the work shoot promo he cut on Raw in 97, his tag team with Owen Hart and the day that Owen died, his good housekeeping match with China at No Mercy and what led to him leaving to go back to WCW, the Hogan situation at Bash at the Beach, the formation of TNA, and his departure from there, his issues with alcohol abuse, and then finally going into the WWE Hall of Fame 4 years ago. It felt like he was honest in parts, and other parts they clearly either just glossed over, or Austin didn't ask him about certain things, which was disappointing. But they opened the interview with the topic I wanted to hear about the most, which was the supposed heat between the two of them at one time. They did bring up the story of Austin working for Jeff's father in the USWA and getting, well, I got more than one low payoff, but there was one in particular. He was in the locker room backstage in Evansville, Indiana one night. He's staring at his paycheck. Can't believe how low it is. And in comes the promoter's son. Here comes Jeff Jarrett. Up from behind him, patting him on the back and telling him, it ain't going to get any bigger by looking at it, boy. And Jeff admitted that he did say it. He remembers it. And he used to say the same thing to a lot of people. He heard another wrestler say it once and he thought it was cool. He thought it was funny. Austin played it off like, oh, he thought it was funny too. And there was never any heat there. Everything was all hunky-dory. Like it was just some rumor that spun out of control that he had heat with Jeff and his dad over the low payoffs. But I'm almost positive it was in Austin's own book that he talked about the low pay that he got down there and having to live off boiled potatoes while the Jarretts were not exactly starving. Bruce Pritchard and Vince Russo both, I know, not exactly the picture of truth on all subjects, but they've talked about Austin's issues with Jarrett, and Bruce said Austin didn't want to work with him because he felt Jarrett was mid-card. You know, he was beneath him, which he was. And the night that Jarrett came back to the company in 97 and he cut that work shoot promo on Raw, that was all Russo. Russo and Jarrett were friends at the time, not so much these days. They had a falling out, but Russo brought him in with the idea that he could work a program with Steve Austin, or at least that's what he told him, that he would work a program with Austin for the title at some point. And Russo was the one, he scripted out that promo for him, but it was Jeff who stuck the line in there about Austin 316 being blasphemous and how Austin was just using the Bible as a tool to make money. He was profiting off the Bible. He had told Russo he wanted to add that in there himself, and nobody ever bothered to run this by Steve Austin. So as Russo tells the story, when Jarrett got to the back, and mind you, this was his very first night back in the company, he said Austin's bald head was blood red. He was so mad. He was all over Jeff. As soon as he came through the curtain, not physically, but he was, that would be funny, but he was all over him verbally when he got to the back. And Jeff was shocked. Like he was begging off. He couldn't believe Austin was so upset. He was completely caught off guard by this. And Austin said to him, he goes, you're messing with my livelihood by saying that stuff. And right after that, Russo said Austin pulled him aside and flat out told him, don't you ever book me with that son of a bitch. And then he told Russo about the USWA days. And you know, the 316 stuff is what really set him off. But he also used to work for Jarrett's family, and they paid him so little he had to live off boiled potatoes. Russo said he had no idea. And really, how could I actually believe him on that? How could he? You think Vince Russo was running his little video store in New York in the early 90s, tape trading for stuff from Memphis? Give me a fucking break. How the hell would he know that unless Austin told him? He said 6 months later, he thought maybe Austin had gotten over things and he tried to book him in an angle with Jeff Jarrett. They're at TV one day and, you know, what are we doing tonight? Well, we're going to book you in an angle with Jeff. And Austin pulled him into a room at TV. And he read him the riot act and he basically told him, motherfucker, did you not hear a word I said 6 months ago? He hadn't forgotten. None of this came up in the interview, which was disappointing because they showed part of Jarrett's work shoot when he came back. And they specifically left out the part where he shot on Austin. How do you bring up that promo and leave that part out? You know, like if they want this to be a fluff thing and they don't want things to get adversarial or whatever because it makes things uncomfortable or whatever, then you almost can't even bring that segment up because Austin, the guy sitting across the table from him, is one of the key people he brought up in that promo. So they didn't show any of that. They left that out. Austin actually brought that stuff up himself on an interview that he gave on an old show called Get in the Ring Radio back in 2003. That was the same year that he retired. the hosts asked him about the heat with Jeff Jarrett, and he actually brought up that night in Cleveland at the Gund Arena, 6 months after Jarrett returned, him being pitched on doing an angle with him, and he said he went into a room with Russo. He thinks Vince and some other people may have been in there, the other Vince may have also been in there. He doesn't remember who else was in the room. But he remembers going into a room with Russo, and he gave him the mother of all cuss jobs. And he said, I told you sons of bitches I never wanted to work with this guy, and now you're going to make me come here and play the bad guy. And he also didn't think that Jarrett was physical enough, that he didn't hit the ropes hard. He said he didn't hit the ropes hard enough to bust an egg. He had like a violent, stiff style in the ring, and Jarrett didn't. Then there was the situation with Deborah, who was on TV with Jeff at the time, and she had been with Jeff in WCW as well. That didn't last long in WWE, once she and Austin started dating. And Jeff even said on his podcast with Conrad, however many months ago, that's why they got split up. That's why you didn't see Deborah anymore with Jeff Jarrett on TV. Once she got together with Austin, you know, it's like, well, we're going to take her away from you. So it's nice that they get along fine now, but there was definitely some whitewashing going on here. I'm not saying the interview needs to be, again, confrontational, but you come away from it thinking that it was all just an internet rumor. It was all BS about, you know, there being any issues there. But yes, there were definitely issues there. I don't think there was ever any heat from Jeff Jarrett's end towards Austin. I think the heat went entirely in one direction. Absolutely. We learned that Austin thinks that With My Baby Tonight is actually a really good song. And he's not wrong. It is. It's a very catchy tune. And knowing now what Road Dogg sounds like, you can't not listen to that song and not hear his voice. But at the time in 95, when Jarrett was doing the lip syncing, I had no idea. I didn't know what the fucking roadie sounded like. I mean, you know, they had me wondering if it was really him or not. But after years of hearing Road Dogg on the mic and in DX and everything, there's not a doubt in the world now when you listen to that song who the voice is behind it. They showed highlights of a great match that Jarrett had with Shawn Michaels at the July 95 In Your House. That was a big night for Jarrett. They were in Nashville. He did the live performance of With My Baby Tonight earlier on the pay-per-view, where he lip-synced the whole thing. And then he went out and had a match of the year caliber match with Shawn Michaels. And according to Jarrett, the reason he disappeared after that was that his back went out on him. Because after that, we didn't see him again for months. He said, well, I had a bad back and it went out on me. And, you know, I was carrying more weight than my frame really should have been at that time. And again, this is one of those things where I don't think we got the whole story. Jarrett and Rhodey walked out that night in Nashville after the match with Shawn Michaels. They were supposed to shoot an angle in the back that night to start the split between them, which would have led to a match at SummerSlam. And, you know, instead they left the building. Like, legit, they left the building before they could shoot the angle. I remember they had Michael Hayes. This is when he was, Doc Hendricks, the backstage interviewer. They had Doc Hendricks in the back, standing outside their dressing room, and you could hear like screaming and a commotion going on behind closed doors. And he said, you know, oh, I could hear fighting going on, and, you know, but we never actually saw Jarrett and Rhodey. We didn't see them because they weren't there. They walked out, allegedly because they thought it was too soon for them to break up. They didn't like the creative. They didn't approve of it. They had a good thing going and they thought they were breaking it up too soon. So they didn't want to do the angle. You know, Jarrett lost his title. Now he's going to be exposed as a fraud. And they were going to split him and the roadie up. So he bailed. And the roadie, out of loyalty, went with him. And for months, there were on-again, off-again conversations between Jeff Jarrett and Vince McMahon trying to patch things up. None of this was mentioned. Jeff came back to the company in December. So he was gone for about, 4 months or so, to work a program with Ahmed Johnson. They had a match at the Royal Rumble, and right after that, he was gone again. And he didn't show up in WCW until he was legally able to do so, which was October of 96. So I was hoping to hear more about the issues that led to him leaving in 95. And again, I was left feeling that we didn't get the whole story. 1 year later, Right now we're in 97. He's back in the WWF. They tried a bunch of things with him that didn't work. They went back to the Double J stuff. They put him with Colonel Robert Parker. Remember old Tennessee Lee? It just felt like a relic. You know, it was the beginning of the Attitude Era. And it just felt like it felt very much out of place. He ended up in a tag team with Owen Hart. And this is where he talked about the weekend of Owen's death. He and Owen worked a match with Edge and Christian the night before the Over the Edge pay-per-view. So that was Owen's last match. Was Owen and Jeff against Edge and Christian. And right at the last minute, he was up to his usual pranks. He was actually late to the building that day. Edge was there, Christian was there, Jeff was there. They were trying to go over their match. Here comes Owen. And Owen had bought two red clown noses. And he had one and he gave one to Jeff. During the match, Edge and Christian got each of them in opposite corners and they were climbing up to do the 10 punches in the corner. Christian told this story, actually, once on his old ENC podcast with Edge. When they looked down to do the 10 punches, they saw Jeff and Owen had red clown noses on their face. You know, Owen would always try shit like this just to get people to crack. But anyway, the next day was the pay-per-view. And Jeff Jarrett's match was on right after Owen's match. It was supposed to be the Blue Blazer against the Godfather, and then Jeff was going to go out there with Deborah to wrestle Val Venus and Nicole Bass. So they're off in the arena somewhere, getting changed and getting ready, and the ticket manager, I think he said the guy's name was Matt, came in to grab Owen and said, look, we got to go. We got to take you up to the rafters for your entrance. And Jeff figured, okay, he has a certain amount of time now to get ready before he had to go out for his match. And when they came for Jeff, a little bit later, he thought, wait, what? I'm not ready. There's no way Owen's match is over that quickly. So at first he said that when he heard Owen fell, he thought maybe he fell off the top rope or something. He thought it was his knee. I guess Owen was having some knee problems. He thought he hurt his knee. He goes, oh man, he must have, you know, hurt his knee or twisted his knee or tore something or something. Something happened. He had no idea that he had fallen 80 feet from the ceiling. And it wasn't until he went out to the ring and he saw a divot in the mat, in the corner where Owen fell, that he realized how serious the situation was. And as soon as the match was over, he jumped in the back seat of a cop car. The cop car was on its way to the hospital. And he was asking the cop on the way, how bad is it? Tell me something. What am I walking into here? Why won't you talk to me? And one of the cops turned to look at him, you know, in the back seat and told him it's not looking good. You know, it's one of those nights where if you watch the show live, you will never forget where you were. You will never forget who you were with. I remember to this day. And it still makes me sick just thinking about how unnecessary it all was. They talked about his Don't Piss Me Off run in the Attitude Era, which was the best run he had in WWE. They showed him breaking guitars over the Fabulous Moolah's head and putting Mae Young in the figure four. The classic WCW segment where he smashed a guitar over Beetlejuice's head backstage. And the segment where he broke a guitar over Gary Coleman's head, which I have no memory of. That must have escaped me. They showed highlights of it too. I know it happened. And Jarrett told a funny story because during the segment, Coleman had a hat on his head, like a baseball cap. And it fell off his head and something fell out of his hat. And he quickly scurried to grab it. He stuffed it back in his hat and put the hat back on his head. Well, he was so worried about taking this guitar shot. And they told him beforehand, like, it's fine. You're going to be fine. It's gimmicked. You're not going to get hurt. But he was so nervous, he grabbed toilet paper, rolls of toilet paper to stuff in his hat to try to pad his head. And the fucking thing came off before the guitar shot. And he had to quickly pick up the toilet paper and put it back in his hat. And put the hat back on his head. And then Jeff hit him over the head with the guitar. I have no memory of this. This was my first time seeing it. I have no memory of it. But they showed highlights of the Good Housekeeping match with Chyna at No Mercy, where he put Chyna over and she won the Intercontinental title. His contract had expired the day before. Jim Ross was the head of talent relations and he dropped the ball on that. I mean, they had their second biggest title on somebody in one of the key matches on that show. In the middle of a wrestling war, although by that point WWE was so far ahead of WCW, but yeah, they're still a war going on. And his contract 24 hours earlier expires. How does that even happen? So he thought he should be paid more. He was in the middle of the hottest run of his career. His logic was, and he's not wrong, his logic was, if they're not willing to pay me more now, especially when business is booming and Vince is about to take his company public, then when am I ever going to get a raise? If I don't get a raise now, I'm never going to get one. My stock probably can't go any higher than it is right now. So he had already made the decision to leave. He knew his contract was about to expire. It did. He signed with WCW. This all happened very quickly. He didn't get into any of the stuff, though, about holding up Vince for money that night. In fact, he said that when the match was over, he went to the gorilla position and Vince stood up and the two of them hugged. And he thought that he was leaving on good terms. No bad blood at all. Maybe, perhaps naively, he thought that he was leaving on good terms. The story is a little bit more complicated than that. And he did not address any of this. And again, this is one of the more interesting parts of this guy's career. And this was just completely glossed over. Now, Jarrett has told two different versions of this story before. The gist of it, though, is this. Jarrett's contract expired the day before. Jim Ross thought he had a verbal agreement with him to re-sign. So again, when I said before, how could something like this happen? Jim Ross thought he had a verbal agreement. Learned a very hard lesson. Get it in writing. Which he didn't. He thought wrong. And so when he showed up at the pay-per-view, he made what JR called a power play. Jarrett said he only wanted the money that he was owed before he would agree to drop the title to China. He had no issue, you know, doing the job and putting her over, doing business the right way, but he wanted the money that was owed to him. He technically was no longer under contract. He didn't have to do the match if he didn't want to. There was no contract to breach. He wanted to do business the right way, but he wanted what was owed. He said there were pay-per-view bonuses that he was owed for June, July, August, and September. They had just done a pay-per-view in the UK, the Rebellion show that he wasn't paid on yet, because it could take months to get paid on some of these things. He wanted that money and all the house show money that was owed to him. Now, he's never said how much he got. He would only say that he got stock options in the company's IPO. China actually floated this idea in her book that Vince Russo and Jeff Jarrett were in cahoots through all of this. Russo had already left for WCW a few weeks before this. I guess the idea is that Russo, as the head writer before he left, intentionally kept the belt on Jarrett, figuring that his contract was about to expire. And then he would be able to squeeze McMahon for more money. Or maybe he thought he would bring the belt to WCW. I don't know, but that was the conspiracy theory that she floated. To listen to Jeff talk about it here, it was all just a minor disagreement. He and Vince hugged and everything was left on good terms. If it was, then Jarrett would have eventually made his way back to WWE when he was done sitting out the remaining months on his WCW contract when the company went under. And that didn't happen. He did say here he had 6 months left on his deal, so he sat home and got paid to do nothing. Like Hogan, like Hall and Nash, like Goldberg, he would have ended up there eventually, but he didn't. He had to start his own promotion with his dad, because he had nowhere else to go. I don't believe that if he knew he had a path back to WWE that he would have started up his own company. There would be no TNA if Jeff Jarrett thought that he had a foot in the door to go back to WWE. They showed the footage of Vince McMahon the night of the Raw Nitro simulcast, singling out Jarrett, pointing at him on the monitor. He's on WCW television, pointing at Jarrett and saying, "When this night is over, J-E-double-F is going to be G-O-N-E gone." And Jarrett said he didn't see it as Vince burying him or blacklisting him. He thought naively that he thought it was the start of an angle. He goes, "Well, why is he singling me out? This must be part of some plan that he has." That must have been one long-ass angle, because it was 18 years before he stepped into a WWE ring again. I guess Vince was playing the long game. They talked about the Bash at the Beach incident with Hogan and Russo in 2000. Jeff knew the plan was for him to lay down for Hulk, but he only learned that a few hours before the pay-per-view. As late as 5 o'clock that afternoon, he was still planning a full match with Hogan with a DQ finish. Then plans changed, and Hogan wanted to know, okay, coming out of this, what are the plans for me? I guess Russo didn't have a good answer for him. So Jeff was upset that he never got to work a real match with Hulk Hogan. He was looking forward to that. Obviously, for him, that would have been a big deal. And he didn't think it was smart to work the paying customers into thinking that they were getting the match when they had no plans of delivering one. But he was happy to come back out later on and work the match with Booker T and put him over at the end of the show. He talked about TNA for a little bit and the platform that it gave people like AJ Styles, like Samoa Joe, like Bobby Roode to become stars. He did not get into the controversy where he started dating Karen Angle after she split from Kurt. Nobody knew that Kurt and Karen had split. They thought that Jarrett was just dating this guy's... literally just started dating this guy's wife. Nobody knew that they were already on the outs. I don't know that they were officially divorced yet, though. Technically, I think she was still Kurt's wife, but they started dating, and it caused this real problem at first. Now, eventually, Kurt and Jeff, you know, they worked together, and they even became friendly with each other, but it was a real dicey situation at first. And Dixie Carter went to Jeff and asked him about it, and he denied it. And when she eventually found out that he lied to her, she was very upset, and she suspended Jeff. I think he lost some of his power in the company. None of that was brought up. But him and Kurt Angle, they did go on to work a program together when he came back eventually, and they actually had some pretty damn good matches together. Those are some of Jeff's better matches from his TNA run with the matches with Kurt. He talked about his drinking problem. It got very bad. He remembers the day that he hit rock bottom in October of 2017. He spent almost 60 days in rehab, and it was right after he got out. So he got out right in time for the holidays. Now it's the new year, and he gets the call to go into the WWE Hall of Fame. And that's kind of where they wrap things up. So there was definitely some stuff left out that I would have liked to have heard him address. But I thought overall he came across well. There was a fleeting mention of Global Force Wrestling, but no mention of Global Force Gold. I wanted to know how many of those gold bars he sold. He never told us. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jay Diamond, what's going on, Jay? Says, I've been listening to your podcast through middle school and high school, so I want to thank you for your show being a part of my life for so long. Now on to the questions. With Wheeler Yuta representing AEW in the Best of the Super Juniors tournament this year, who do you see entering the G1? Says, my guess is either Samoa Joe or Lance Archer. Also, what are your thoughts on Moxley and Danielson in the World Tag League? I would love to see Danielson in the G1, absolutely. Schedule-wise, probably not going to happen. I think that would be tough. I could see Andrade in the G1. You know, Samoa Joe, I think, is possible. Or maybe Pac, right? He's not doing much these days. I think Pac in the G1 would be cool. Moxley and Danielson in the World Tag League, probably unlikely due to the scheduling issue. I mean, again, unless they get bounced early. And if I'm Tony Khan, I don't know why I would approve of them being bounced out of it early. Then I think the issue really becomes what kind of time commitment is needed for two of Tony Khan's biggest stars to leave for, you know, it could be 2 weeks. You know, I have an easier time seeing Santana and Ortiz or FTR in the World Tag League than I do Moxley and Danielson. Anthony wants to know, I agree that WWE having a pay-per-view each month is too much. I get why they do it. They've been doing it for years. But having fewer pay-per-views each year makes the events feel more special. So here's my WWE pay-per-view schedule. January, Royal Rumble. March, April would be WrestleMania. June is Money in the Bank. August is SummerSlam. November is Survivor Series. What say you? I would agree with that. But Money in the Bank... I would make a change. I'm looking at this schedule. I see Money in the Bank in June. And basically, King of the Ring was in June. It used to be a June pay-per-view. And they got rid of King of the Ring. King of the Ring is dead, right? They King of the Ring is dead. It's not coming back. They'll dust it off as a TV gimmick every now and then. King of the Ring as a pay-per-view concept is dead. So now it's Money in the Bank. And Money in the Bank being so close to SummerSlam, I would make a change. And the change I would make is this. I don't think Money in the Bank should be for the instant cash-ins anymore. I think it's played out. We've had almost 20 years of these Money in the Bank cash-ins. Sometimes they can be exciting. I just think it's played out. What if you did Money in the Bank? You have a men's ladder match and a women's ladder match. You can put briefcases up there if you want to, but the winner of the Money in the Bank match, much like we have the Royal Rumble, is supposedly going to guarantee you a title match in the main event at WrestleMania, you know, two or three months later. Money in the Bank can be to SummerSlam what the Royal Rumble is to WrestleMania. And so the winner of the men's ladder match is guaranteed a championship match in the main event at SummerSlam. The winner of the women's ladder match is guaranteed a championship match against their brand's champion, whoever the women's champion is, at SummerSlam. That's the tweak I would make with Money in the Bank. That might be a hot take. Some people might vehemently disagree with that. You're free to disagree. I think the concept is played out. If you're going to have a pay-per-view schedule like that, that's what I would do. You keep Money in the Bank as an important show, but you just tweak the rules a little bit, and what's on the line is just very different than what we're used to Money in the Bank being. To change in the concept. You're keeping the name, you're keeping the match, you're changing the stakes. Julius from the Bronx, in your opinion, what wrestler, past or present, had the best top rope finisher? To me, he says nothing beats AJ Styles' spiral tap, and it sucks that he physically cannot do it anymore. Yeah, you know, he's talked about the spiral tap before. I think it put a lot of stress on his back. Or maybe his back and his hips. He's a lot older now. He could probably pull it off if he wanted to, but he might not come out of it in one piece. So I get why he doesn't do it. The answer is Randy Savage. Randy Savage and the Flying Elbow. It's a thing of beauty. I also have to go with Neville's Red Arrow, or Pax Black Arrow, whatever name you want to use for it. To me, that it's such a beautiful move. And the way he lands it and just sticks the landing, I've never seen him, you know, land it anything but perfectly. And the hang time he gets on it, I mean, it's fantastic. Montez Ford and the hang time he gets on his frog splash is also pretty high up there, but I got to go with Savage, but give that honorable mention to Pac. Daniel from Hamburg. Did we ever come close to a Hulk Hogan versus Giant Gonzalez match in the summer of 1993? I heard rumors that this was one of many plans for Hogan after he did not want to lose to Bret Hart. Apparently, there was even a face-off between Hogan and Gonzalez at a house show after the King of the Ring. What if Hogan against Gonzalez had happened at SummerSlam? So this is true. He did actually have a face-off with the Giant Gonzalez. It was at a live event 2 days after the King of the Ring. It was Hogan and Beefcake. They were the Mega Maniacs taking on Money Incorporated, Ted DiBiase and IRS, in a lumberjack match. And I remember the photo. If you look around, you'll find the photo. I think it was a scan from some magazine. I don't know if it was a WWF magazine or not, but it's a photo. You see Hogan in the ring. Clearly, he had just wrestled. You could even see the smoking guns outside the ring. They were probably two of the lumberjacks. It's weird seeing the smoking guns in the same image with Hulk Hogan. I mean, again, by that point, Hogan in that era, you know, I was talking about the Jeff Jarrett thing before, and when they brought him back in 97 during the Attitude Era, and they gave him the old Double J gimmick, and they put Tennessee Lee with him, and how it didn't really fit. Hogan at this point also, not that he wasn't over, but that whole Hulk Hogan babyface gimmick in that era of WWE at that point, it wasn't really a good fit. He felt out of place. But you look at the image, and there he is. He's in the ring. He's kind of pointing at the Giant Gonzalez, who's standing, you know, hands on hips, I think, across the ring from him. And it's striking how tiny Hogan looks standing in the same ring with him. But then again, everybody looked tiny compared to the Giant Gonzalez. I mean, the guy was 7'7". Yeah. I heard the same thing, that if Vince McMahon had either gone through with Hogan dropping the belt to Bret that after SummerSlam, or if he didn't want to work with Bret, but he had stuck around, that maybe that would have been the SummerSlam match, that it would have been Hogan against the Giant Gonzalez. Now, I'm not sure how true that part of it is, but clearly, you know, based on what they did here at this show, they were testing the waters with their little face-off. And that would have been a horrendous match. I mean, Hogan made a career out of beating Giants back in the 80s, but by 93, he felt so out of place in that company. Gonzalez would have been the worst of all the Giants that he would have ever faced. He was awful. Nice guy, based on what everybody said about him. He was a nice guy, but could barely move. He couldn't do anything in the ring. Thankfully, we were spared. But Gonzalez did make a couple of appearances on Hogan's Thunder in Paradise show. At least with that, they had the magic of editing to make it look not as terrible. And Frank from Long Island, WWF Winged Eagle Belt, is without a doubt the greatest design for a championship in the company's history. I agree. But which star would you find it synonymous with? The spinner belt is synonymous with John Cena. The new WWE Championship is synonymous with Roman Reigns. For the Winged Eagle, in my opinion, he says it's synonymous with Bret Hart. I would love to hear your thoughts on all three belts. The Winged Eagle, yes, I think it's synonymous with Bret. I would agree on that, absolutely. And he held that belt more than Hogan did. Hogan's the other name I was going to mention. Hogan was the first to hold that design. And he had that championship four times. Well, five, technically. Five times. And so I got to put Hogan on the same plane with Bret. Because Hogan is up there as the first person I associate it with. But Bret is right there with him. Bret had it six times. Wait, did Bret have it six times? No, Bret had it five times. What am I saying? Bret had it the same number of times that Hogan did. Okay, well, they're equal. There you go. Why did I think he had it one extra time? I was probably thinking of Austin was the WWF champion six times. But anyway, yeah, I would put Bret and Hogan up there together. It's hard for me to go one over the other, so I'll put them both on the same plane. Spinner belt, John Cena for sure, obviously. The modern logo belt. Yes, I would agree with you. I would go with Roman Reigns as far as who I associate that with now. If you want to throw in some more belts, you want to throw in the Attitude Era Big Eagle belt, I would go with Steve Austin. And the Undisputed belt, Brock Lesnar. I think of that belt, and I know fewer people held that belt. Brock had it, Kurt Angle had it, Big Show had it, Eddie Guerrero had it, JBL had it. I think it was around that time it got phased out, but of all of them, I still associate that title with Brock. Some good shit, though, man. We used to have some really cool-looking title belts. What happened? What happened in this company? Where did it all go wrong? You can email me again, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Love hearing from you guys. I do read everything you send me, and you never know. You never know, and you may hear your question used on the show. I'm going to be live with you tonight as soon as Hell in a Cell is over. We're going to go to hell, and then we're going to go live on YouTube and talk about it. So you get two podcasts in one day, and I guarantee you it will not be as late of a night as it was with Double or Nothing last week. Probably not as good of a show either. But it will definitely be an earlier night tonight. So if you're not already subbed to the channel, do me a favor. Go to the YouTube channel, hit that subscribe button. Make sure the notification is on. That way when I go live, it'll let you know. And the first thing I need you to do when you get there, even before I go live, is hit that thumbs up. Because when you hit that like button, it will help the video. It'll help people find the video in their YouTube recommendations. So, if nothing else, do me that favor. I will see you guys tonight. I will also see you back here next Sunday for episode 760. We've done almost 760 of these things. And again, you should not have any issues with the move over to Spreaker, which is already done. You should be listening to this just as you always do. And hopefully you guys will download the Spreaker app. And again, hit that star button, hit that star icon, and that way you'll like and follow the show on Spreaker. But very excited about the move. I will see you guys tonight for Hell in a Cell. Until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the rest of your day and week. And back here again for 760 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonsters sounds off.
After the match, Shanky, he danced with Samantha Irvin at ringside. And Samantha Irvin has a big smile on her face, and she gets up and she starts dancing. Everybody's dancing. I wish they would take the writers of this show and they would take Vince and Bruce and lock them in a fucking room. Let Shanky book the show. It'll just be the dance-offs up and down the car. We'll have Walter. Let's have Gunther go out there and he can dance. Every match, right? We'll have the Usos dancing. We'll have Roman Reigns dancing. We'll have Riddle dancing. Pat McAfee's up on the announce desk. He's always dancing. Michael Cole can dance, right? 25 years. Let's have a celebration. He can start dancing around, right? The crowd will start dancing around. The referees will start dancing around. Adam Pearce can start dancing around. Max Dupree can start dancing around. It'll just be one big fucking dance fest. I don't even know what I was talking about.
The Solomonster sounds off each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.